It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out what books you love to read and reread and what's still on your list.
First, a recent survey conducted by the Wisconsin Alumni Association found that there are a substantial number of business startups among graduates of the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Joining us now to tell us more about the results of this recent survey is Aaron Oliver, Managing Director at University Research Park. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, tell us about this survey. What were you looking to find out here?
Well, the university is really committed to the Wisconsin idea, the idea, the notion that the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state. So we're interested in finding out, when Badgers graduate, what are they doing and how many of them are founding companies. And we did a survey with the help of the Wisconsin Alumni Association and found out there's a lot of entrepreneurship, not only all around the country, but all over Wisconsin. So we were excited to find over 800 unique Wisconsin companies in our sample. They're in more than 200 cities in Wisconsin and in 51 of the 72 counties.
So not just clustered in Madison or in the Madison area.
Definitely not. There's obviously a lot at right here where I'm standing at University Research Park, and people a lot of times think of the biomedical and IT-related companies that are spinning out of the university here in Madison. But we actually found, you know, more than 200 different cities had UW-Madison startups. And this, keep in mind, is just a sample. It wasn't a census of everyone, so there's probably a lot more than that. There's probably a lot more cities represented if we could find every single one. But I think what it shows is that people are not only starting companies that are commercializing the research from the university, but they're also taking the education that they get, the connections that they make, the ideas that they're exposed to, the friendships they form, and the experiences that they have back to their own communities or communities that they decide are great places to raise families. And they're starting all kinds of different businesses, food processing businesses, small manufacturing operations, financial service firms, brew pubs. Any number of different types of firms were represented in the sample.
Now, this all comes in the midst of, as you may have noticed, a state budget negotiation. It includes university funding, possible cuts. Do you see this as a selling point to take to lawmakers to say, hey, the state's getting some value here?
I certainly hope so. You know, when you think about what makes Wisconsin special, there's a lot of things that we really take pride in here, our great quality of life, our great K-12 schools, the Green Bay Packers. But the University of Wisconsin is one of the things that's really special about the state, one of the things that's really different than other states. We're doing $1 billion of research here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and that research base is bigger than all but three other universities nationally. We're doing more research than Harvard, than MIT, than Stanford, Yale, you name it. And so part of one of the big advantages we have is that kind of research base attracts incredible faculty, incredible students, and it not only helps Research Park take those ideas and turn them into companies like Stratatech or Cellular Dynamics, but it also is exposing students to all kinds of different enrichment experiences while they're here, and they're taking that back to communities across Wisconsin in the spirit of the Wisconsin idea.
Talking to Aaron Oliver, Managing Director at University Research Park, about a recent survey looking at entrepreneurship among UW-Madison alumni around the state and around the country. So, Aaron, is it a focus, you know, when you've got undergraduates here at the UW trying to get them prepared for entrepreneurship to start up startups?
I think it's more and more of a focus both at the university but also among the students. There's a trend going on in the workforce where you're seeing more and more people forming their careers by essentially freelancing, by being contingent workers and putting together careers that they're really driving themselves. And I think that trend is going to continue. The university had a grant from the Kauffman Foundation a few years ago to ramp up entrepreneurship on campus, and I think that it's a mirror image. The university is doing more, and the students are demanding more. And I think that's going to continue. And it's great for our economy because we know that the startup of new businesses and then their growth as they scale is what creates most of the jobs in the nation. So from 1977 to 2005, the Kauffman Foundation found that big companies actually destroyed about 1 million jobs a year on average on a net basis, whereas the startups and scale-ups created 3 million a year on average.
So how do you teach this? Is this, you have Entrepreneurship 101, you have a class on this, or is it wider, something in the broader education that you're shooting for?
You know, one of the things the survey tried to get at is what actually matters. And one of the most significant things for the students was coursework, which I don't think is surprising. And you can take courses in entrepreneurship. You can also take courses in skills that might help, computer programming or accounting or management, communication. But they also mentioned, one of the things that they mentioned often was experiential learning. So the university has created, for example, entrepreneurship-oriented residence halls where students who are interested in startups and being entrepreneurs can live together and benefit from bouncing ideas off late at night after class or working on companies in the lounge together. And then, of course, the other thing that people mentioned pretty frequently, about a quarter of people mentioned either faculty relationships, research experiences, or relationships with other students as being important factors to their startup.
Are there things you think that UW-Madison or other campuses, for that matter, can do to encourage more entrepreneurial spirit among students?
Yeah, I think, doing things that make it visible and helping people see that this is a viable career path. So celebrating entrepreneurial success, being proud of entrepreneurs, making it easy for them to connect to each other, having places that they can, maybe co-working spaces where they can get together and collaborate. Anything that you can do to kind of strengthen the community and make it more visible, I think, has the potential to create virtuous circles of growth. And I think that's a strategy you're seeing around Madison and around the university here. But I think it's also a strategy that can be employed in just about any community in Wisconsin.
Yeah, when you say startup to people, I think the first place that might pop into mind is, Silicon Valley or other places around the West or even East Coast. Do you think people are starting to see Wisconsin, a place like Wisconsin, as fertile ground for business creation?
There is a great article recently that came out demonstrating that Wisconsin was actually number two in sort of these second stage companies that scale rapidly. And oftentimes they're a little bit older, they're a little more mature, they're oftentimes in manufacturing related fields. And that's something where Wisconsin has always had a real strength. We're one of the most manufacturing intensive states in the country. And so people think of startups and they think of venture capital funded companies trying to pursue a drug discovery or create software. And those are certainly important. And that's something that the University Research Park is really focused on advancing. But entrepreneurship is a lot broader. There's people starting professional service firms or restaurant chains or any number of companies that have the ability to create jobs and bring money into communities across Wisconsin. And supporting that and cheering for that and helping connect entrepreneurs so they can support each other, buy from each other, promote each other, can really help strengthen the economy across Wisconsin.
There's been a lot of concern about brain drain in communities around the state, the idea that, we've got these students, they are from Wisconsin, they come from outside of Wisconsin, they get an education somewhere in the state, and then they go somewhere else to find a job or they go somewhere else to start up a business. So how can we harness the people coming out of the school who want to start that business to try to get them to stay somewhere in the state?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. When you look at the last decade, I think Wisconsin has lost something like 45,000 people in the sort of 18 to 30 demographic or so. I don't know if I remember that statistic exactly right. Madison area has actually gained about 10,000 of them. And I think that the things that are working here are, one, having growth in some of these dynamic fields that attract top talent, university-educated talent. And I think also really making sure that communities are great places to live, that we're protecting the natural resources we all enjoy, that we're investing in great schools. Those sorts of things make a big difference in terms of livability and keeping talent here. One of the things I saw in the survey when we got the results back, which I was really heartened by, is that we found entrepreneurs, graduates who were from all over the country, even the world, really. But over half of them were still in Wisconsin. So that's sort of telling me that a huge number of that we're not grabbing everyone, but a huge number of the folks that have the guts to go out and put their name on a shingle or borrow some money from a bank or friends and family and start a business, over half of them are staying and choosing to do it in Wisconsin, and they're choosing to do it all over.
Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Aaron Oliver, Managing Director at University Research Park.
Coming up, we want to know which books you love to reread. Are there tried and true comfort books that you go to over and over again, and why? You can call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Look forward to taking your calls after a look at the news with Kristen Durst.
It's a triumph for President Barack Obama on Capitol Hill. Sweeping legislation to strengthen the administration's hand in global trade talks advanced toward Senate passage today after a showdown vote that remained in doubt until the final moment. 62-38 vote was two more than the 60 needed. U.S. stocks have closed slightly higher, led by an advance in energy stocks as the price of oil climbs. The Dow edged up a fraction of a point. The S&P rose 5 points. The NASDAQ climbed 19. Governor Scott Walker missed his first-term job creation promise by about 121,000 jobs. Walker promised during the 2010 campaign that if elected, Wisconsin would add 250,000 private sector jobs over his 4 years as governor. But job numbers Walker released for 2014 show that only 120,000 private sector jobs were created. For Central Time, I'm Kristen Durst. We'll have more news coming up at 4:30.
Toyota Camry, Chevy Silverado, Honda Goldwing. What do all of these have in common? You travel in them, they use up fuel, and when you donate them to WPR, they become the great radio programs you enjoy every day. Put your old vehicle to work making WPR programs possible. Go to WPR.org/support and thank you.
Support for WPR comes from the Manitowoc Area Visitor and Convention Bureau, where visitors can enjoy miles of Lake Michigan coastline, including bike trails, lighthouses, shipwrecks, and more. Info at manitowoc.info. Manitowoc. Coast for a while. Support also comes from Copper & Kings American Brandy, located in Louisville, Kentucky. 100% copper pot distilled and aged in bourbon barrels. Non-chill filtered with no added sugar, oak flavor, or caramel color. CopperandKings.com.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, does the media respond differently to violent white people compared with violent black people? Some critics are saying yes in the wake of the biker gang violence in Waco, Texas.
First, as the world gets ready for the sequel to Harper Lee's groundbreaking novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, seems like a good time to reread that first book written about 50 years ago. Harper Lee's website is urging people to do just that from May 21st to 31st. The sequel comes out on July 14th. It's called Go Set a Watchman.
And while we're at it, the idea got us talking here at Central Time about the books that we like to reread, and we want to hear from you on this. What books did you read when you were in high school or later that are maybe worth a second read now that you're older? And what is your favorite book to reread, your comfort book that you turn back to again and again? What book do you always reread because maybe it makes you think? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
While you're calling in, we'll give a listen to a clip from the movie adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
Clip from To Kill a Mockingbird, the movie version. We're being encouraged to reread the book version. Guilty announcement. I never read the book version. I didn't read it in high school. I didn't read it later.
I was just going to say the same thing, but you beat me to it.
Bit of a spoiler alert.
I haven't
in that
read
clip
it,
there.
But so I guess we can't reread it, but we can read it for the first time.
Read it twice. Now we want to hear from you. What book do you want to reread? Do you love to reread? Maybe something you go back to again and again and get something new out of it every time. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now and start out with Dan in Menominee. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. So there's a Wisconsin author by the name of Patrick Rothfuss who's written the first two books of a trilogy, The Name of the Wind and Wise Man's Fear. And his world-building skills, I'm not kidding here, put him in the same box as Tolkien for me. So every time I go back, there's just so much more to notice. It's just a wonderful, wonderful series.
Dan, you're preaching to the choir here, I think, with me and Veronica.
We know of this Patrick Rothfuss you speak of, and we share. We're anxious for the third book.
Right. And so my plan for rereading those, Dan, I think is going to be when the third book is about to come out, I'll hit the first two again to gear up for it. But you're not waiting. You've reread them anyway.
Oh, of course, yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Dan. And definitely a two thumbs up here from me and Veronica on Patrick Rothfuss for a read and a reread.
Definitely. All right. Thanks for that. We're going to go next to Jody in Cross Plains. Jody, hi.
Hi. When I was in high school, I read all the Jane Austen books, and I reread them starting again when I was about 45, and they are way better when you reread them. Oh. They're a lot funnier.
A lot funnier, because I tried to read them when I was younger. I think maybe when I was in my low 20s, and I thought they were nice, but they didn't grab me. But I'm interested maybe to try them again. Thanks for the vote.
Yeah, that's, again, I haven't read Jane. So I've got, that could be a whole other conversation, the should books, because I've got this huge should read list in my head, and maybe someday I'll catch up with all of that. But now we're taking your recommendations for books to reread at 800-642-1234, a post on the Central Time Facebook page. We polled a WPR staff, Kirill, from WPR, or one of our engineers here, said anything by Thomas Pynchon. I reread V and Gravity's Rainbow every year. My knowledge of history and my appreciation for his interlocking conspiracies, she says, increases with each immersion. That's one that's on my I ought to reread list. I've read, not Gravity's Rainbow, I've read a lot, and that would be worth a reread, a lot of his books.
And I'm starting to feel really unread. I haven't read any Pynchon.
I recommend it. Yeah, I like it. I mean, it's heavy. Sometimes you got to build up a head of steam to get going on.
Well, he influenced David Foster Wallace, who's one of my favorite writers.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, definitely worth a read for me. He's going to go on my list. Thank you for that. We're going to go next to Kelly in Oregon. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I would recommend Grapes of Wrath. I just reread it again, and I think it's a really fascinating book to read, especially when you look at it in light of, like, some of the things that John Steinbeck talks about are really very much true today with how we treat people sometimes in poverty and how we should really do a better job of working together and looking out for humanity. So it's really inspiring when I get done reading it, and I always look forward to getting to read it all the time.
Wonderful. Thanks, Kelly. You really you put in a great pitch for that book, and I think that's one I have read a long time ago, but
yeah,
maybe not the whole thing. I'm not sure.
Kelly, thanks a lot for the call. Paul joins us next in West Bend. Paul, hi.
Hi. How are you? One is Cairo, The City Victorious, by an economist writer by the American University Press in Cairo Press. The other one is The Story of Stupidity, and it's a history of Western idiocy from the days of Greece to now. And I actually read these. They're really intriguing books.
And, Paul, these are both nonfiction worth a reread.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Some nonfiction entries. Thanks for those, Paul. I'm trying to think. There've got to be some nonfiction ones. I've been thinking fiction only so far, but if I rack my brain,
yeah,
I've got to come up with some nonfiction
rereads. That's a great challenge, nonfiction rereads. Thank you, Paul. And Peter from here at WPR said, personally, I found E.B. White's collected essays have stood the test of time. The man understood the English language deeper than most people, an understanding that led him to write the Bible on grammar, Strunk and White.
Yeah, it's Peter sitting over there. Let's see if you heard us talking about him.
No,
he's not looking up. Well, very poetically expressed, Peter. Thanks for that. We'll go now to Paul in Wisconsin Rapids. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I like Rum Diary, Hunter S. Thompson.
I've never read Hunter S. Thompson, so make the case. Sell me on this one for a first read and maybe a reread, Paul.
It's like late 50s, early 60s, Puerto Rico, and he's just coming from the downfall of lots of corruption. But like anyone going for journalism would be awesome to read it, because it's just kind of like a go-to book where you could write a thesis off of.
I've heard of his later stuff. What's the title of that one, Paul?
Rum Diary.
Rum Diary. Okay, great. Yeah, thank you so much.
That's a book that has been recommended on these airwaves before. So now that it's come around full circle again with Paul, I think we definitely need to take it seriously.
It's like advertising. When we hear something six times, we'll actually do it. Thank you so much for that, Paul.
And next is Monica in Greenfield. Monica, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about two short reads. The first one is The Little Prince, a French book that probably a lot of our listeners have read. My mother read it to me when I was a little girl, and then I read it when I was a young girl, and then I read it to my children, and now it's been a big anniversary, and there are a lot of very nice new reprints, and I'm ready to read it on my middle age.
Excellent.
It's
Monica, I like that
book.
That intergenerational reading and reading it to the subsequent generations. We're doing that right now in my family with Watership Down, which I adored when I was younger, and now my kids are reading it. And I think that's an interesting way to reread it and get a fresh perspective, too, just like you're doing.
Well, thank you
for your recommendation.
We've got Max now on the line in Minocqua. Max, hi.
Hi, it's Matt, actually.
Matt, hi. What's your reread, Matt?
Well, first of all, I'm shocked that neither one of you has read To Kill a Mockingbird. That's crazy.
I really regret, Matt, that I admitted it on the air.
Actually, it's funny this topic came up because my goal this summer is to reread Catcher in the Rye.
Oh.
I read it back when I was in college, and now I'm almost 50, so I wonder how... reading it again when I'm older, how I'll interpret it or whatever. So I think that's my goal for the summer. So
Matt, that's interesting. And that's one that's almost the poster child for one that you might look at differently depending on how old you are.
That's a great one. And also Susanna from here at WPR says she wants to reread that one for the same reasons that you just gave. I have actually reread Catcher in the Rye.
Oh.
And I thought
Did it change?
I thought it stood up really well. I think that there are timeless things about it, which maybe is the mark of a great work of literature. It's timeless, but I don't know, everyone has a unique reaction to books, but it's worth a try.
Definitely. Rick in Bayfield is with us next. Rick, hi.
Hi. I would strongly suggest reading the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I've read it three times, and I'm planning to start into it again next week. It's about 1,000 pages long.
I was going to say, it's a big read.
It's a big read, but it gives people a perspective on what happened to the world during that particular era, and a lot of people would, I think, gain a tremendous perspective on what was happening and what could happen to a country.
Rick, thanks a lot for the recommendation for Rise and Fall of the Third Reich for a read and a reread.
Okay, I think we have time for one or two more. Angela's next in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling to recommend the trilogy Kristen Lavrin's Daughter by Sigrid Undset. She's was a Norwegian author. She died in 1949, but she won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1928 for her work. And it follows. It's about the life in the Middle Ages, and in Norway. And there's, like I said, it's a trilogy. Oh. I've read it three times. Oh. I read it about every decade now. And they're just fabulous. And particularly for someone who, she was just a master at describing winter weather.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Good read for Wisconsinites, too. I know you're a Lord of the Rings rereader, Veronica.
Right, I was going to try not to expose my nerdery in this particular.
I've exposed it now.
But yeah, I did try to reread it once a year, but I haven't this year.
My thing is lately audiobooks. A big science fiction book, Alistair Reynolds or somebody, I've read it already, and it's like approaching it again, but in audiobook form. So that's my spin
a good way
on
to go.
That. Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody, for your thoughts. And don't forget, you can keep that list growing over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Last Sunday, a shootout between rival motorcycle gangs in Waco, Texas, left 9 dead, 18 injured, with 170 arrests. The rival gangs converged in the parking lot of a Twin Peaks restaurant, and as violence broke out, police were reportedly shot at, and they returned fire.
The violence comes at a time when the national media has been focused on police interactions with black communities, and directly on the heels in Baltimore, on the riots, rather, in Baltimore, that were heavily covered by the press.
Some critics have pointed to the police response and media coverage of the Waco, Texas violence as an example of how racial bias persists in the work of police and media, that on the whole, white-on-white crime is treated differently than black-on-black crime in American society. Jesse Holland joins us now. He's a race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Later, we'll be joined by Rutgers Communications Professor Aram Sinreich. Jesse Holland, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, can you give us a recap of the events of that day? What happened in that parking lot in Waco?
Well, from what we've been able to tell so far, there was a meeting of motorcycle clubs at the Twin Peaks restaurant in Waco, Texas. Police had already been alerted that this meeting was going on, and so a SWAT team was already there. And the details are differing, but right now what the police are saying is that an uninvited motorcycle club or gang, motorcycle gang, had shown up at this restaurant, and a fight broke out, and the police got involved, and 9 people were fatally shot. There's still some discussion, because the preliminary autopsies have not been released yet, of actually who shot who. We don't know whether it was bikers who fatally shot bikers or police who fatally shot bikers. But what we do know is that 9 people are dead, 170 people have been arrested, and each one of them that had been arrested is on $1 million bond.
Now, this is important to the story we're telling about media coverage. What was the demographic makeup, from what we know anyway, of the bikers involved and arrested?
From what we have seen from mugshots, the majority of the people involved were white male. There were some Hispanic males, and there were some African-American-looking bikers there as well. And there were women. But from what we've seen from the mugshots released by the police, the majority of the people there look white.
Now, you, in a piece, looked at response to police action and to media coverage. And some people you quoted were focusing on what the scene of the shootout looked like after things had settled down. Can you describe those scenes that people have been reacting to?
Yes. Several commentators, including TV1's Roland Martin, and several other people who looked at the images coming out of Waco, saw images of police officers standing around looking nonchalant while bikers, who we assume were later arrested, were able to use their cell phones. And they compared those pictures to pictures from Baltimore, where you had police in riot gear confronting protesters and looters. And the question came up of why was the police response in Waco seemingly so mild when the police response in Baltimore seemed so excessive? Now, obviously, these are two different situations. The situations in Waco happened over a matter of minutes and was over. The situation in Baltimore went on for days. So there was obviously, there's no way you can make an apple-to-apple comparison. But some people looked at those images and wondered, why was the police response seemingly one way in Waco and another way in Baltimore?
Talking to Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, comparing reactions to what happened in Waco, Texas, people drawing comparisons between police response and media response to that incident, this biker gang shootout in Waco, comparing it to things like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, and elsewhere. Now, on the journalistic side, Jesse, some of the criticism has been in about how journalists used words, and pundits for that matter. Thugs, the word thug deployed when there was black involved, violence or rioting, the word rioting used there, but not in Waco. What have people been saying about that compare and contrast there?
Well, one of the things that most people focus on when they look at journalism, they don't focus on the news stories. They focus on the columnists, the commentators. And what a lot of people saw from the commentators behind Baltimore was that the protesters, some of whom were violent, but a lot of whom were not, were immediately castigated in the media and called thugs and criminals. Even President Obama used the word thugs when he talked about the violence going on in Baltimore. However, when you have Waco, you had people who called them criminals, but then did not go any further than that. the people in Waco were not immediately stereotyped and castigated in the same way that the people in Baltimore were. And some commentators and some media critics, there was even one, at least one newspaper, did a editorial cartoon wondering why there wasn't the same outcry about societal concerns and poverty and families behind the Waco incident, which, by the way, ended in fatalities, as there were in Baltimore, which ended in no fatalities.
So in your own writing about this, this piece you wrote, I was looking at the comments you got in reaction. Not surprisingly, there's a strong partisan divide in this country. These issues are divisive. A lot of response, angry, heated response. What kind of things were you seeing in response to your reporting?
Oh, we always get... That's when you know you've written a story that has actually touched a nerve, is when you get the angry responses. I've been getting tons of both positive and negative comments on this story. One of the things that I've learned as a journalist is that a lot of people confuse the message with the messenger. What I did was write a story about a conversation that's going on in the African-American community, and a lot of people have taken that to be something that I think is going on, instead of something that I'm reporting, a conversation that I'm reporting that's happening. Now, this conversation is going on, and it's been going on for a while, but a lot of these conversations don't ever make it into the general public's view. This is one conversation that has. So it's bringing out a lot of passionate responses from a lot of different readers, which I love, which means that they're actually reading the story, that people are actually talking about this issue. And conversation is one way we can help end a lot of problems in America.
Jesse, you write about, as we said, race and ethnicity issues. You've written about various attitudes toward policing in the past, this current story now. As you're covering this stuff, do you sometimes second-guess yourself or think, why am I choosing that word instead of this word? How much second-guessing goes on?
Well, as a journalist, you should always be careful with every word that you use, because our stories have impact. So I always second-guess everything I write, even as it's being written, and then even more after it's published. Because as a journalist, it's your job to be as fair and present things as fairly as you can. So I always question what I do, and I always read everything that people send me about my stories, because there might always be a point of view that I don't know. So you always work hard to make sure that everything you write, every word you use, is the correct one. And we do a lot of that at Associated Press. We have editors whose job is only to read those stories and make sure we're using the appropriate words. So we do a lot of fact-checking and content checking to be sure that the words that we use are the correct ones for the situations that we put them in.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, talking about criticism of possible racial bias in police and media responses to this biker gang shootout last weekend in Waco, Texas. Coming up, we'll hear more from a communications professor about potential media bias in particular.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the media and society at large respond differently to violence committed by white people compared with violence committed by black people? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls after Look at the Latest News with Kristen Durst.
We're talking about whether the media has a racial bias and how it covers crime committed by white people compared with crime committed by black people in the wake of the biker gang shootout in Waco, Texas. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We just heard from Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer at the Associated Press. Now we're joined by Aram Sinreich, assistant professor at Rutgers University's School of Communication and Information. Aram, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So based on what you've seen, do you think the media coverage of these shootings in Waco is an example of some kind of racial bias, conscious or unconscious, in the media?
I do, unfortunately, and I think it's largely unconscious. And it's a very complex problem that media and communication scholars have spent decades and reams of paper trying to address. And unfortunately, it's not the kind of thing that we can fix with a silver bullet. But being aware of it and having the kind of conversation that we're having now and inviting on, you know, self-conscious journalists like Jesse Holland to explain how they approach their practice, I think is a very good first step.
So on an unconscious level, so how does that work? Is it that, you know, the media has these narratives in their mind and they fit the story to it based on what they're seeing? What happens there behind the words?
That's a great question. So there are a number of different mechanisms at work here. And at the most basic, I think a major problem is that we don't really have newsrooms that reflect the diversity of the American public at large. Right, even today, and you know, well into the second term of America's first African American president, 90% of the people working in a newspaper newsroom are white. 92% of the guests invited to opine on Sunday television talk shows are white. 98% of the owners of television news stations are white. So, at a very fundamental level, you have a lack of diversity of viewpoint being caused by a lack of diversity of background among the people responsible for generating and disseminating and framing the news stories. And then from there on, there are more complex problems. Like, as you say, you know, language has a way of insinuating itself into the way that we think. And the more that we tell ourselves, and I mean that collectively as a nation, that you know, black people committing violence collectively are thugs, whereas white people committing violence collectively are criminals, or that, you know, black people out on the street is a riot, whereas white people out on the street with guns is a shootout. The more we kind of segregate the language that we use to describe these scenarios, the more prone we are to reflexively repeat that segregation in our own language. And then, of course, you know, those linguistic rifts emerge into social rifts and drive us further apart as a nation.
Well, I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think there definitely are some differences, but it's really hard to compare, like your previous guest, that was just terrible, terrible comparison. It's like comparing Girl Scouts to ISIS. It's ridiculous. But there are most certainly a certain amount of racism going on in this country. We know it. It's blatant. It happens every day. But once again, there's not – name the last time that there was a large group of all whites that went through their neighborhood and looted and trashed their businesses, and then the following week complained that they had no businesses left in their neighborhood. It's really tough to compare.
This actually happens – fairly frequently. You know, they were just riots having to do with a major sporting event a few months ago, which was largely white-driven riots, that led to the destruction of thousands of dollars in property. There was a big riot over Halloween a year or two ago, and pumpkins were a big element of that story. The problem is that when these things happen, when young white people take to the streets and commit violence, either for political reasons or for cultural reasons, they're looked at and framed in the media as miscreants. You know, oh, these kids are just no good, or these kids just made a mistake. And when black people do the same thing, the entire African-American community is held accountable for their actions. And there's this public outrage about the, you know, the influence of hip-hop music and about, you know, what about, you know, all these single-parent families. And you know, there's this notion that African-Americans are doing this to themselves, are somehow culpable for the actions of the members of their groups, whereas there's no equivalent hand-wringing over single-parent white families or poverty in the white community or, you know, white power as an ideology when people from a European background do the same kinds of things.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. I mean, another criticism kind of along those lines in this particular instance is with this Waco shootout, whatever we want to call it, this is definitely a distinct criminal element. This is a different criminal organizations all in one place at the same time. Whereas watching coverage of what we've called riots in other cities, it looks like, at least from the coverage, we see members of the community at large. Is that a fair comparison, first of all? Is this apples and oranges?
Oh, it's definitely apples and oranges. But I think it's an apples and oranges that highlights rather than detracts from the kind of analysis that you're trying to do in this story. I mean, from at every level, you know, the police were more courteous and considerate to the Waco shooters than they were to the Baltimore protesters, even though the Waco shooters were criminals and drug dealers and, you know, had hundreds of weapons, and the Baltimore protesters were largely, you know, nonviolent civilians standing up for their civil rights, right? So there's a disparity in terms of how the police react. There was no riot gear used in Waco. There was no National Guard called in. There was no kind of proactive fencing off of area. I mean, there was a little bit of effort by the police to go in and try to make peace, but even that distinguishes itself. So the fact, I mean, if we were comparing a shootout between the Crips and the Bloods to a shootout between these motorcycle gangs, that would be a more apples-to-apples comparison. But the fact that things went so much worse for the Baltimore protesters than they did for the Waco criminals, even highlights the disparities in terms of our racial attitudes in this country. So there's the police treatment, and then there's the media framing. You know, these are still, when nonviolent protesters who are African American take to the streets in Ferguson or in Baltimore, as I said before, the news media tends to focus on, you know, the social pathologies that they believe led to these people embracing violence. And when people actually commit violence, premeditated collective murder in Waco, because they're white, nobody's wringing their hands over the white community, and its culpability in those actions overall.
Talking to Aram Sinreich, he's an assistant professor at Rutgers University, talking about media coverage of violence in different communities. We'll go back to our callers with Christine in Superior. Christine, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I am from rural Wisconsin, northernmost point in Superior and bordering Duluth, Minnesota. And there is definitely in this town, these two towns, a glaring disparity, the disparity between the way whites and blacks are treated by the police. And I don't know if that is because we are so rural and not as diverse, or if there's more to it than that. But I have dealt with it every day, day in and day out from the time I was young. I've lived through my whole life, right up until nonviolent domestic disturbance with me and my ex, and I actually had to hire an attorney to fight four felony counts. And mind you, this was a nonviolent offense. I had no prior record. I was a full-time college student and a mother, and I was facing four felonies. I don't know of a domestic disturbance where that happens with whites, but I'm sure maybe it does. I hope.
Christine, I want to ask: are you African American yourself?
I am half, actually. I'm half white and half black, so I feel like I have a great perspective on both sides of the fence, because I don't really fit in either place. I'm really not sometimes perceived by certain blacks as not black enough, and by whites as, I'm not white, so I don't fit there either.
Christine, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get Aram in on this while we still have time. She's saying this, far from the big cities we've been talking about, this permeates daily society. It maybe also permeates the media, Aram.
Yeah, I think it does. And you know, there's been ample research done on the media framing of violence from a racial perspective, and it all really points to this overarching, you know, top to bottom, inside to outside, implicit bias in the way that we frame and cover the stories. And it does leak into people's lives, like this poor woman, where the police in her town probably were more primed for a violent encounter in her case than in her neighbor's case, because maybe they perceived her as being non-white. I mean, I can't speak to those specifics, but again, the research points to overarching bias in the media framing, but also overarching unconscious bias in the actions of police officers. And by the way, this is just as true of police officers of color as it is of white officers. They both behave in a way that is consistently biased against citizens of color. This is a national problem, and I'm actually really relieved that we're beginning to have this conversation, because it's not like it began with Trayvon Martin or with Ferguson. This has been going on since before the Civil War.
We'll take another caller now. Thanks for that, Christine. We've got Malia in Winona, Minnesota now. Malia, hi.
Hi. I just want to make a point. We're talking about reading through what we write and being very sensitive to what we write. But Do you understand that motorcycles clubs are clubs? They are not gangs. And we keep referring to all of these clubs as gangs, and it's very offensive.
What's the distinction, Malia?
What is the distinction? It's a distinction that they are not a gang. They are a club. And that's how they refer to themselves, and that's how they prefer to be seen, is a club, not a gang.
Malia, thanks for the call. And maybe she's leaning toward more of the legal operating motorcycle clubs as opposed to these outfits that were in this shootout in Waco that are also criminal enterprises. A distinction worth making, motorcycle club versus gang?
Yeah, I actually do think it's an important distinction, and thank you for raising that point. I think the more clinical we are in the language that we use to discuss violence, the less room there is for bias to creep in. And I agree with the caller. I don't think the word gang actually serves any purpose. I think it's so vague that it can be used to cover a broad range of different organizations and activities and therefore is valueless. My understanding is that in this case, these particular motorcycle clubs were engaged in organized crime. That's the impression that I get from reading the news coverage fairly closely, but I could be wrong. I haven't looked at the legal proceedings here. If they were engaged in organized crime, then I think gang would be a more appropriate term to use, even despite the vagueness that we were talking about before.
Malia, thanks for that call. And Aram, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Aram Sinrike. He's an assistant professor at Rutgers University's School of Communication and Information, talking about potential bias in the media coverage of white crime versus black crime in the wake of the shootings in Waco, Texas.